I put the problem set 3 on the wiki. I put next Wednesday as the date, but that's after the class finishes running, so that's kind of, that can be kind of a loose deadline. Just feel free to turn it in on May 8th-ish. Are there any questions before I go back to talking about MCMC? Okay. So last time, I was talking about MCMC, which is a method for exploring a likelihood function in a large number of variables by representing the likelihood function as a sequence of random samples. And so the ingredients are our likelihood function, where it's assumed that you know how to evaluate it at a point, but you don't know how to sample it. That is the problem that bridging the gap between evaluation and sampling is the problem that MCMC is trying to solve. And a proposal density which is a distribution that you do know how to sample from for generating a random theta prime from a current position theta in the chain. This can be, MCMC formally works for an arbitrary proposal density, provided only that the strong mixing condition is satisfied, which is a really weak condition. It just means that you couldn't have a proposal density which is just confining its steps to a submanifold of the space or anything like that. So MCMC formally works for any proposal density in the sense that you can run the chain and it will eventually equilibrate to the likelihood function L of theta. But if your proposal density is poorly chosen, then the equilibration time will be really long. It'll take a long time to wash out memory of the initial conditions and get a random sample. And then starting from that random sample, it'll take a long time to get a new uncorrelated random sample and so on. So I'll say a little bit more in the lecture about how you would go about matching, choosing a good proposal density which is appropriately matched to the likelihood function of interest. And the output is a sequence of samples from the PDF given by the likelihood function. Oh yeah, one little technical point that I said last time is that if you look at the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm in detail, it only requires you to ever evaluate likelihood ratios. So you don't need to know, when I say evaluate the likelihood function, I mean evaluate it up to some overall normalizing constant. And that's important since in Bayesian statistics, we never really know this. We rarely know this constant that appears in the denominator of Bayes' theorem in advance. And then you're supposed to use this sequence of samples to answer whatever data analysis question you want to ask about the allowed region of parameter space. And usually that means just projecting the samples into various one-dimensional and two-dimensional parameter spaces. So for example, if your parameters are the parameters of the standard cosmological model, and you run your MCMC and get some sequence of samples, H1, omega baryon 1, so on, and then sample number 2. And then if at the end of the day you're interested in the 95% confidence region on H, say, then what you do is you just keep the H's from each sample and you histogram them. this sequence of H's will be a set of random samples from the marginalized likelihood for H, which is defined by, that is the 1D likelihood defined by taking the full n-dimensional likelihood and integrating out the other variables, which effectively treats them as nuisance parameters. And in a real experiment, you'd probably have a bunch of instrumental nuisance parameters here in addition to the cosmological parameters that are of direct interest. So you could do this. And then if you wanted to know the 95% confidence limits on H, then one prescription for doing that would be to just integrate up this likelihood. Of course, when a 1D likelihood is just represented as a sequence of samples, then so if you had a continuous function here, the procedure for determining the 95% allowed range is just to integrate the function until you accumulate 25%, 2.5% of the total probability. And if this likelihood function is really obtained by histogramming a bunch of discrete samples, what you would do is just take quantiles. You would just take the value of H such that 2.5% of the samples are below it. And so you could repeat this sort of analysis for any of the basis parameters in the coordinate system, or for a derived parameter like, I don't know, omega lambda, which is 1 minus omega matter, or some nonlinear function of these arguments. You could just apply that function to each of the samples to get the 1D likelihood function for the derived parameter. And usually what's done in an experiment is, you might want to, it's hard to visually inspect a likelihood function in six or more variables. But if you visually inspect all of the interesting 1D likelihoods and all of the interesting 2D likelihoods, like if I histogram, if I make a 2D histogram of H versus omega matter, say, then I might see some interesting correlation or structure. Then that usually gives a pretty good understanding of what's going on with a higher dimensional likelihood function. In fact, for a multivariate Gaussian, because the multivariate Gaussian is described by a covariance matrix, then plotting all of the 2D slices through the likelihood completely determines the multivariate PDF. That statement's not true in general for a non-Gaussian likelihood in many dimensions, but it usually sort of suffices for practical purposes. So a few little comments here. One comment is that these samples are correlated. So we talked about in the last lecture, the case where, say, the true likelihood is functioned as a unit Gaussian, and I'm sampling it with a Metropolis sampler that takes unit Gaussian proposals where the width of the proposal density is probably less than the width of the true density. In fact, in D dimensions, the optimal width for the proposal density is something like 1 over the square root of the number of dimensions. So if I have a sample theta 1, then theta 2 won't be an uncorrelated sample from the full distribution. In fact, it'll be pretty highly correlated to theta 1. And after two steps, I'm still pretty highly correlated. And so on until some characteristic number of samples is accumulated, which is the correlation length of the chain. So you could plot, a diagnostic plot that's often useful to make is the, I'll show a plot like this when I show slides in a few minutes, is the correlation between sample I and sample I plus L, where L is the lag as a function of the lag L. And if you want to understand the correlation time of your chain, this is often a useful diagnostic plot to make. And it'll usually follow as something like e to the minus L over L naught, where L naught is a characteristic correlation length of the chain. So the samples are correlated, but that's actually fine for doing this type of histogram analysis. It's still true. You might wonder if having correlated samples somehow screws anything up. But if all I'm doing is projecting all of the samples down into a single parameter and evaluating the 2.5% and the 97.5% quantiles, then those quantiles are still are not biased by correlations between the samples. As long as each sample is individually a fair sample of the 1D distribution, it doesn't matter if they're correlated. The only catch is that you might need more samples than you would think. You might need a lot more samples than you would need if they were uncorrelated. Generally speaking, the number of samples that you need just scales as the correlation length. Like having 10 to the 5 uncorrelated samples is as good as having 10 to the 5 times L0 correlated samples. The same is true in two dimensions, of course. Now, as an implementational detail, especially when the correlation length is very large, sometimes what's done is to thin the chain. So especially if you use sort of fancy packages for MCMC analysis with a lot of features, they might do something like generate this sequence of samples. And then if the correlation length is of order 10, say just keep every 10th sample and discard the remaining 90% of the samples. That's sometimes useful as a little optimization to decrease the amount of disk space that the output of the chain will consume when these samples are all written out to disk, or the length of computing time needed to histogram the chain and compute quantiles. It doesn't really change anything qualitatively anyway, since the correlations never, strictly speaking, go to zero. So sometimes it's useful, but it's not really very important. Another little comment about MCMC is that in MCMC, marginalizing parameters is sort of trivial. Like in this case where we had n parameters in the model space and we wanted to marginalize n minus one of them and get the marginalized 1D likelihood on a single parameter. That's just a trivial operation where you throw away information. You take each sample and you only remember the value of the parameter that you're interested in. So marginalizing or integrating out variables from the likelihood is a trivial operation if you're representing the likelihood as a sequence of samples. An operation which is hard is slicing, where suppose I've run an MCMC in some large model space, and then I decide that I'm just interested in a submanifold of that model space. Like maybe my original chain included some interesting extension of the standard cosmological model, like the equation of state of the dark energy. And now I'm interested in knowing what the parameter, if I want to marginalize that extra parameter, it's trivial. But if I'm interested in fixing it to its fiducial value, if I want to ask, well, what would the constraints be in all my parameters if I didn't marginalize it? I just assumed that it was equal to minus one, the cosmological constant case. Then I'm in the position where I have some sequence of samples that represent the likelihood in a large parameter space. I'm interested in finding a representation of the likelihood in some submanifold of the big parameter space. And generally speaking, that's kind of a hard operation. And the sort of standard solution is just to give up and run a new chain. So just run a new chain, which is restricted to the submanifold. That's usually what's done just to be on the safe side in big cosmology analyses like the Planck analysis. They actually run many markup chains, like order a few dozen, corresponding to all the different extensions of the standard model that they might be interested in. And so this is a difference between MCMC and Fisher matrix forecasting, say, where in the Fisher matrix case, both of these operations were straightforward. Slicing a Fisher matrix just means that you apply the transformation law that we worked out, where you restrict to a sub-matrix of the Fisher matrix or pull back through a Jacobian. And marginalizing generally means that you invert the Fisher matrix and then just take the covariance matrix of the new parameters after the marginalization. So for forecasting purposes, maybe if you were interested in forecasting every extension of the standard model, then it would probably be easiest to just compute like an Uber Fisher matrix with 100 parameters in it corresponding to every extension that you are interested in. And then just, when you compute that Fisher matrix, it would have a ton of eigenvalues close to zero, because this, in cosmology, we generally can't jointly fit for every extension of the standard model at the same time, and there would be huge degeneracies between parameters. But then in a particular parameter space of interest, once you slice the Uber Fisher matrix down to some realistic parameter space, hopefully the small eigenvalues would go away. But for MCMC, you can't do that, and you usually have to run lots of different chains in different parameter spaces. This can either, MCMC analysis can easily eat up every node in a big computer cluster. One plot you might want to make, one diagnostic plot that you might want to make is this plot to determine the correlation length. And sometimes that's useful to optimize parameters in the proposal density. So we talked last time about this case where the true likelihood is a unit Gaussian PDF, and the proposal density is some multivariate Gaussian metropolis proposal density with some width sigma p. So in this example, if you wanted to understand which value of sigma q were optimal, one thing you could do is plot. Really, the best plot to make would be to plot fit for the correlation length as a function of sigma q. And then what you would get is something like this. You'd find that the correlation length blows up if I keep the posterior likelihood fixed, but vary the width of the proposal density that I try to use to sample it. Then the correlation length would blow up for both large and small sigma q. If sigma q is much less, and the optimal value would be at something like sigma p over square root d, where d is the number of dimensions of the parameter space. If sigma q is too small, then the steps in the random walk are highly correlated, and it just takes a lot of steps to diffuse around and explore get an independent sample from the likelihood function. And if sigma q is too large, then the correlation length is high for a different reason, namely the chain will reject 99.9% of the time, since the proposal density usually just leaps out to a region of very low likelihood. And so what you'll get is long sequences of samples in the chain that are all equal to each other, where the chain just rejected. Another diagnostic plot, which is easier to make, is to plot sigma q versus the acceptance rate of the chain. And there you'll get behavior like this, where the optimal acceptance rate is usually around 30%. So as a shortcut, this sort of tuning is usually what's done. The width of the proposal density is varied until about 30% of the samples are accepted. That usually corresponds to roughly to the minimum of the correlation length. One thing to remember if you're a practitioner of MCMC is that if you get a very low acceptance rate, then it's really obvious that something is wrong. But if you get a very high acceptance rate, if you're accepting 99% of your samples, then that's actually just as serious. That's probably just as serious of a performance issue. It means you're somewhere over here where the correlation length of the chain is actually very high. A few more examples. I just want to think about a few more multivariate Gaussian toy examples before I show some slides. So I'm going to continue to think about toy examples where the proposal density is a multivariate Gaussian in x minus x prime. And the true likelihood function, I think I've gone back and forth in between using the notations L of x and P of x. Sorry about that notational inconsistency. There's also some multivariate Gaussian. So an example that's interesting to think about is, so suppose that you decided that you were going to, for all problems, use a proposal density whose multivariate covariance matrix was proportional to the identity, and just vary the single parameter sigma q, tune it so that you get an acceptance probability of order 1, some number like 30%. Then if you think about what happens, so that generally is not a good idea to restrict your generality to a proposal density, which is just a multiple of the identity. If you consider an example where the true covariance is, I still want it to be diagonal, but I want to consider a case where it has very different variances. Then what will happen is I'm trying to sample a likelihood which is very long and skinny like this, with a proposal density which is circular. And there's no choice of sigma q that will lead to a low correlation length. If I make sigma q really large, like this, then I'll tend to reject, the chain will reject most of the time because of large excursions in this direction. And if I make sigma q small, like this, then the chain may accept 30% of the time, but it will have a very small, it will mix well in the vertical direction, but it'll take a long time to diffuse around in the horizontal direction. So generally speaking, it's important to match the variances of the proposal density to the variances of the different model parameters in the parameter space. So you would definitely want to do something like this. In fact, it's also not necessarily safe to take the proposal density to be diagonal, as you can see by thinking about example 3, which is going to just be example 2 rotated by you consider a covariance matrix like this. It describes two random variables that are very highly correlated. And there's no diagonal, even if I let these diagonal elements differ. There's no diagonal proposal density that will achieve a low correlation length here. Diagonal means that the principal, the error ellipse of the proposal density always has principal axes that are lined up with the coordinate system. So there's no way if I have that diagonality constraint to get good mixing along this axis without having a large scatter outside the ellipse and getting a high rejection rate. So generally speaking, you do want to match. You do really need CQ to be at least to cover all cases, like where the diagonal elements here can be have very different orders of magnitude, or where correlations can be large. You do really need the proposal density to have a covariance matrix which is dense, all the elements are independent, and it's sort of matched to the covariance matrix of the proposal density of the true likelihood. So one way to get a good proposal density might be to if you don't know anything about your likelihood function, maybe you could just maximize it. Go to the point in theta space of maximum likelihood. That would be the best fit model. And then just numerically estimate the Hessian matrix around that likelihood and take CQ to be some multiplier times the inverse Hessian matrix, where the multiplier is tuned to give a 30% acceptance rate. For reasonable likelihood functions, this is usually like a pretty safe way to get an efficient chain. Or another thing that might happen is that if this is a cosmological likelihood, maybe you computed the Fisher matrix before you ran the MCMC, and then taking lambda times F to be lambda times F inverse, where lambda is tuned to give a 30% acceptance rate, will usually be a very safe thing to do. So I think the most difficult technical issue in running MCMCs is this issue of finding a chain that just achieves good mixing, which if you're restricting scope to the Metropolis-Hastings sampler, as we'll do in the lectures, then that means choosing a proposal density whose covariance or second derivatives are pretty well matched to the true likelihood function. Now, let me just mention in passing that MCMC is a huge subject, and you can get huge books on it where the Metropolis-Hastings sampler is just like chapter one of the books. And there are many other interesting ideas for other types of samplers that may not use the notion of a proposal density at all. If you get to a complicated enough example, you may find that you outgrow the Metropolis-Hastings sampler entirely and need to open up the can of worms. But Metropolis-Hastings works very well for likelihoods that are sort of tame, and that's generally the case for likelihood functions in cosmology. Now, the other major issue besides getting good mixing is simply the issue of deciding whether or not the MC is converged. And so you might think that that's just a matter of monitoring the correlation length, making plots like this, and just checking that the correlation length of the chain isn't, a million or anything like that. There's more to it, as the following toy example shows. So we talked about the importance of matching. Let's be example four. In this Gaussian land of matching the covariance matrix of the proposal density to the true covariance matrix of the distribution. Consider this example. Let's imagine that the true covariance matrix was the identity. And for some reason, you ended up with a proposal density which was super correlated like this. Then what will happen is the chain will have excellent mixing along this axis, but will take a long time to diffuse in this perpendicular direction. And that means that if your only diagnostic plot for mixing is the correlation, let's call the two variables here x and y. If my only diagnostic for deciding whether the chain is mixing well is to plot the correlation function of x and the correlation function of y, then those plots will look fine. They'll show a low correlation length. Because the chain will mix well along this axis. That suffices to decorrelate, the value of x at one sample from the value of x at the next sample. It's just that there's this one direction. And if this ellipse were turned 45 degrees, then the x plot would show the high correlation length and you would detect it. But in a high dimensional parameter space, it's easy to hide modes that mix poorly, that may not show up in the diagnostic plots because you don't know the coefficients or the direction of the mode in advance. And so The MCMCologists have thought about this problem. How you decide whether an MCMC has converged or not. And the recommended answer is the following. And I wonder if there's a better approach, but this is what everyone recommends. What is recommended is to run, instead of running one enormous chain with, say, a million samples, you run, say, four chains with a million divided by four samples, or eight chains with a million divided by eight samples, where you start the chains off with very scattered initial conditions. So you don't attempt to start them near the peak of the likelihood. You deliberately start them at like just weird outlier places in the parameter space. And then what'll happen is that these chains will sort of, you know, they'll find their way into the bulk part of the likelihood function by following a random walk, which is sort of biased in the direction of the likelihood gradient. And they'll generally, you know, come in different places here. So then if you have this problem, what'll happen is that each of these chains will sort of appear to be mixing well. But they'll give values that are very different from each other. Like if I were to histogram the x's, say, I would get different likelihood functions for the two chains, for the four chains. And so what you have to do is just run these four chains for long enough that all four of the chains give consistent likelihood functions for every parameter of interest. That's the test that's recommended. And I left out some details like exactly what statistic you're supposed to use to decide whether these likelihood functions agree. But you can look up there. And there's more than one version of this idea. The version that seems to be most widely used is the so-called Gell-Gell-Mann-Rubin test. If you're interested, you can look up the Gell-Mann-Rubin statistic and see what criterion you're supposed to use for deciding whether these subchains are consistent with each other. Okay. So that's all I have to say about MCMCs in the lecture. Since the subject is sort of visual, I thought I would next just show a few MCMC plots. So I'm told that when I plug this in, the AV gods, well, oh my god, the AV gods know everything. They're already lowering the screen. So I just want to show some plots of an MCMC in action, and almost all of the slides will relate to this toy example, which I coded up from scratch in a few hours, just to show that MCMC is kind of no big deal. It's not something that you need a fancy software package to do, although fancy software packages do exist. So here's my toy example. So consider a 2D Gaussian random variable with a covariance matrix which is constrained to have this form. So I'll allow a correlation beta between the x and y axes. But I'll constrain the variances of the x and y axes to be equal. And the only real reason for restricting this example to two parameters is so that the entire likelihood function can be represented in a 2D plot on the screen. So for my fiducial values of alpha equals 10 and beta equals 5, here are 10 random samples from that 2D Gaussian. The question that I want to ask is that if you're just given these samples and you don't know which value of alpha and beta produce them, then how would you do the data analysis? If this plot represents your data, then how would you do the data analysis to determine which values of alpha and beta are allowed? So if you want to be Bayesian, then you define the problem as having a problem with these two model parameters, alpha and beta. And then my data D consists of these 10 points. And I try to write down the likelihood. First off, I'm going to assume a uniform prior. Forgot that detail. Then I'm going to write down, the next step would be to write down the conditional likelihood of the data given the model parameters. That's just the multivariate Gaussian likelihood. If I only had one point D, then its conditional likelihood given an alpha and beta would be given by the expression for the multivariate Gaussian PDF, where the covariance matrix C depends on alpha and beta, and that's what makes the right-hand side a function of alpha and beta. And then if I have n points, then they're all statistically independent, so I just multiply their likelihoods. So this is a simple closed-form likelihood function that has 10 terms in it that you can compute straightforwardly. And so as sort of a formal step that where nothing really happens in this problem, the posterior likelihood is given by multiplying the conditional likelihood times the prior. And the prior is uniform, so nothing equal to 1, so nothing happened in this step. I guess the only thing I have to remember is that I wrote equals here when I was writing down the conditional likelihood and proportional to here, just to emphasize that in the conditional likelihood, you know the normalizing constant. This 2 pi appears in the multivariate Gaussian likelihood so that the integral of the likelihood function will equal 1. Once I flip things around to get the posterior, I don't know what I would get if I integrated this function over alpha and beta. So there's some overall constant here that's not determined. So I have that posterior. And this is a toy example. So, you know, and only if you're only ever interested in analyzing problems in 2 variables, then I doubt you would ever really need to use MCMC. Like in this example, I have this likelihood function. Once the data is specified, my posterior likelihood is just a function of 2 variables, alpha and beta. And it's really fast to compute. So there's no problem with taking all of the alpha and beta values in this plot, putting them on a grid, and just evaluating the likelihood function as a function of alpha and beta. And when I did that, this is the region that I got. You know, I forgot to put it in the plot. Maybe it's just missing in this version. Yeah, the later plots do show it. But the color coding here is supposed to be, what I did is I took the likelihood function, and then I thresholded it. The x is the fiducial model. And then I took the likelihood function, and I thresholded it at the threshold value that would give 68% of the total probability. In other words, if I integrate the likelihood, 68% of the integral is in this region, and 95 and 99. The fiducial model, you can see, is slightly offset from the peak of the likelihood function, which I didn't actually compute, but I guess it's around here. And that's normal. It's normal for the best fit parameters to differ by the true parameters by 1 sigma or so. And you can see the fiducial model does lie inside the 68% contour. So in this toy example, this procedure is really a complete analysis. It tells you everything you need to know. You don't really need to run an MCMC. But that's sort of the point of the toy example, is that we know the exact answer, and we can compare the MCMC to it. And of course, if you had more variables, then you wouldn't be able to grid. You would have to run the MCMC. So before I show the MCMC, just a little thing. I never really showed a concrete example of comparing the Fisher approximation to a true Bayesian posterior. I said that the idea of Fisher forecasting is that the Fisher matrix is describing a multivariate Gaussian or a set of error ellipses, which are supposed to be an approximation to the level contours of the true posterior for a typical realization of the data. So in this example, and you can already see in advance that the Fisher approximation is not going to be great for this likelihood, since if the Fisher approximation were perfect, then all of these level contours would be ellipses, and they're definitely not ellipses. There's definitely some non-Gaussian structure to this posterior. So just to play with the Fisher matrix a little bit and compare it to the posterior. First off, we need to know what the Fisher matrix is for this likelihood function. And that's not like a trivial calculation. You have to take I need to differentiate this likelihood with respect to the model parameters A and B, alpha and beta. That's actually not a trivial calculation, since you have to take the derivative of a determinant. So there's a linear algebra identity there that says that if I differentiate the determinant, I get the trace of the matrix inverse times the derivative of the matrix. So this is sort of an aside. I didn't go through all the steps in the algebra. Let me just say that it's not supposed to be obvious, but this is the Fisher matrix that you get can be computed from this likelihood function and has this closed form. You take the to compute the Fisher matrix, you need to know the covariance matrix of the data in the fiducial model, and then the derivative of that covariance matrix with respect to the different parameters in the model space. So here's the result of comparing the Fisher approximation to the true Bayesian posteriors. These are the 68, 95, and 99% contours that you would get in the Fisher approximation. You can see it's really not a great approximation. It sort of captures, you know, the order of magnitude extent of the 68% ellipse. And it does capture the fact that there's a positive correlation between, like, it gets the correlation roughly right. But the 99% ellipse, for example, is way off the true one, and it's not capturing this non-Gaussian structure at all. The Fisher matrix is supposed to be a good approximation in the limit where you have a lot of data, where you have many copies of the data set. And in this problem, that just means increasing the value of n, which is 10 in the data set that I analyzed. So it ought to be the case that if I increased n from 10 to 100, say, that the Fisher approximation works much better. You can see, I tried that, and you can see that it's actually working pretty well. The error contours now look like ellipses, and the Fisher matrix is getting the scaling roughly right between the 68, 95, and 99% contours. This isn't really doing this comparison between the Fisher matrix and the level contours of the posterior is not like something that you need to do when you're running an MCMC or anything. It's more of a little side topic from the previous lectures when I was talking about the Fisher matrix. I just realized I never showed an example of the Fisher approximation in action. So going back to MCMC, I have this model parameter space, alpha and beta. I have a likelihood function, L of alpha and beta, that I can evaluate anywhere in the space. So I decided to run an MCMC. I deliberately chose, just for like illustrative purposes, a starting point that was pretty removed from the main part of the likelihood. Even if you didn't know the fiducial model, you could, for example, start the chain at the point of maximum likelihood. To run an MCMC, I need a proposal density. And so I decided to use a Gaussian in alpha and beta with width 4 in both parameters. I cheated a little bit and used this plot of the posterior, which you wouldn't normally have in advance, to just guess that a width of 4 would be about right to get good mixing. Then I started running my MCMC. I started at this point and sampled from the proposal density. I just added a Gaussian random number of variance 4 squared to each of the values. Here's the first point that was proposed. It turned out that had a lower likelihood than the starting point. So the acceptance probability here, the likelihood ratio, was around 5%. There was a 5% chance that this point would be accepted, but that's not what happened. The chain decided to reject it, as it would 95% of the time. I rejected that point and stayed at alpha 0, b 0, which is why I showed, when bookkeeping the chain so far, I showed two copies of that point. Then in the next step, something similar happened. I got a really tiny acceptance probability, and the chain rejected. So I now have the initial point is in the chain with multiplicity 3. On the third step, the chain did decide to accept. It proposed a point that had a higher probability likelihood than the original point. And in that situation, the chain would always accept. And the next step, it took this little baby step, and the likelihoods were almost equal. The new point was a little bit less likely than the old point, but the likelihood ratio was 0.99, which meant that the chain was going to accept with probability 99%. And unsurprisingly, it accepted that point. So now I have these three points in the chain where I have to keep track that the first point is in there with multiplicity 3. After continuing in this way, after 20 steps, the chain actually really hadn't made much progress. I think it started like here, and it made it to here. So it's sort of undergoing this random walk, which is sort of tends to go uphill into the region of higher likelihood values. This chain, by the way, has a an acceptance fraction around 55%, which is a little too high, and I probably should have used a wider proposal density, but I didn't bother rerunning it. After 50 steps, it's really starting to get somewhere. After 100 steps, it's really started bouncing around in the mainly in the 68% part of the likelihood. After 1,000 steps, I decided to stop plotting the arrows and just plot the points that were sampled. And you're always supposed to keep track of multiplicity. So the color coding of these points is keeping track of how many times the sample appeared in the chain, or the rejection count at each point. So one phenomenon you can see here, this is a little detail that I didn't really talk about, is that this set of points, if you want to say that this set of points is a fair set of samples from this likelihood, then one problem with that statement is that I have this wing of points down here which have very low likelihood and are just an artifact of the starting point of the chain. So usually in practice, you want to discard some number of initial samples to account for the burn-in when the chain is still correlated with the initial conditions. And in this chain, discarding order 100 samples is probably plenty. A common rule of thumb says that you should discard. A commonly used rule of thumb says that you should always discard the first 10% of the chain, even for a chain that's run for like a million samples. And that's usually super conservative. Like in this problem, it would be extremely conservative if you ran the chain for a million steps to discard the first 10 to the 5 samples. But on the other hand, the uncertainty on quantities of interest, like 95% confidence limits, due to the finite number of samples, tends to scale like 1 over the square root of the number of samples. So, but if you're super conservative and discard the first 10% of the chain, then at worst, that would just mean that you're paying a 5% price. You have 5% more uncertainty in things than you could have. So usually people, because there's not much of a price to being super conservative, usually people just use this rule of thumb, even though it's probably overkill. Okay. In this example, I discarded burn-in and in the remaining plots by dropping the first 10% of the points. And then you can see after 10 to the 5 steps, it's really starting to capture this likelihood function. By the way, just as a little detail, in this problem, the beta can never be greater than alpha, or the absolute value of beta can never be greater than alpha, which is why there are these diagonal lines with no samples. And I handled that in my implementation by if the chain proposes a value where beta is greater than alpha. The reason why beta can never be greater than alpha is because the covariance matrix would not be positive definite, and could therefore, it just wouldn't make sense to use it as a description of the covariance matrix of the samples. So I handled this in my implementation by saying that the chain is allowed to propose an unphysical point in parameter space, but they're just assigned to likelihood 0 so that the chain never accepts. After 10 to the 7 samples, which was easy to run on the laptop because this likelihood just has 10 terms in it, it's super fast to evaluate, you could see that the MCMC, this 2D histogram of the points in the MCMC is capturing really well all of the features in the exact gridded likelihood function. Although the color scale is different, so it's hard to compare super precisely. To do a super precise comparison, I decided to look at 1D histograms, so just to convince myself that there were no, everything was working here and there were no bugs. So here's the 1D likelihood function for the parameter alpha. If I were interested in the constraints on the model parameter alpha, the variance of the points, and I didn't care about beta, I didn't care how correlated they were, then this is the plot that I would want to make. And the orange histogram, I'm just histogramming the alphas of all the points in the chain. And the blue curve is the exact result, which I computed by taking the likelihood function, which I can write down analytically as a function of alpha and beta, and then just integrating it with, you know, with Python scipy dot integrate, integrating out the beta coordinate. And you can see that they do agree exactly. Now, a little detail here. It's very easy in MCMC, unfortunately, to make bugs that make the answer slightly wrong and are difficult to detect. So as an example, I deliberately introduced the bug in my code where you'll recall that in MCMC, in the Metropolis Hastings MCMC, if the chain rejects, you're supposed to duplicate the point in the chain. You count it twice, or you know, a number of times equal to the number of rejects. And so I deliberately introduced the bug in my code where if I rejected, I didn't append another copy of the point onto the end of the chain. And so the green histogram shows what you would get if you just histogrammed all the points in the MCMC with multiplicity 1 instead of the true multiplicity that the point should have, which is the number of times the chain rejected at that point. And you can see that if you do that, you do get a slightly wrong result. The green histogram is not matching the blue curve, but the orange histogram is. Here's a diagnostic plot I like to make, which is just the correlation coefficient between samples separated by lag L. By the way, you know, I realized before you make this plot, you should subtract the mean of alpha from alpha I and subtract the mean of beta from beta I. I'll update the slide before I post it on the wiki to include the mean subtraction. So both alpha and beta this chain has a correlation length, and both alpha and beta of order 30 or so. So when I ran the chain for 10 to the 7 steps, the number of independent samples I was getting was really more like 10 to the 7 over 30. Provided, of course, that I'm assuming here that there's no problem analogous to this one where I have hidden modes with poor convergence. But in this problem, the parameter space is small enough and the likelihood function is tame enough that I'm pretty sure that's not the case. But it might be hard to tell in higher dimensional examples. That's MCMC. It's really no big deal as long as you have a proposal density that matches the Hessian matrix of the likelihood function pretty well, and the likelihood function is reasonably behaved. And a real world example like this MCMC that I just grabbed randomly from one of the Planck papers, which is a chain involving, you know, a whole bunch of cosmological parameters, you know, our friends like omega baryon h squared and omega c h squared, and also a bunch of internal nuisance parameters in Planck that have just been marginalized out and are not shown in these plots. And the only difference, like this sort of Metropolis-Hastings sampling would work just fine for a problem like this. The only differences are that there are going to be more variables in the parameter space. The number might be more like 15 or 20, but that's really no big deal. Things scale pretty well. MCMC usually scales pretty well with the number of dimensions. And the likelihood function is just much more complicated. For a given point in parameter space, that is, for a given set of cosmological parameters, to evaluate the Planck likelihood function, you have to first run CAM to compute CLs from the cosmological parameters, and then run another Planck-specific piece of code, which the Planck collaboration provides. You can download it. That will tell you, for a given set of CLs, the posterior likelihood of your CLs given the observed Planck sky maps. That's all I have to say about MCMC. I have one more lecture tomorrow when I'm gonna, so if I had like 10 more lectures, right now I would say we've built up like a pretty complete toolkit for thinking about cosmological data sets, being able to Having all the machinery of random fields in different numbers of dimensions, knowing how to compute the Fisher matrix in different situations and its abstract properties, and knowing how to run MCMCs is sort of the toolkit that you need to start doing observational cosmology. And if I had like 10 more lectures, what I would do is go through all of the different examples of random fields in cosmology and how they're analyzed and what parameters they constrain. Things like CMB polarization, CMB lensing, galaxy clustering. But since I only have one more lecture, I'm only going to get to choose one of those. And so tomorrow I'm going to decide to talk about CMB polarization for one lecture, and then that'll be the end.